I thought I would start with something that I knew you would already have seen, and that is this transition that Bill talked about from sinus rhythm, where we have activations of the ventricle on the order of about once a second or so, to ventricular tachycardia, where we have activation at the shorter intervals, but the activation is still reasonably periodic, and then the degeneration of ventricular tachycardia into ventricular fibrillation. And one of the ideas that's been floated in the past decade or so is that this transition from a normal sinus rhythm to ventricular tachycardia to ventricular fibrillation results from a transition in wave dynamics from a planar wave to spiral waves, in particular a pair of counter-rotating spirals or vortices, and that these may then break and form multiple spiral waves. But that idea is reasonably recent and really is an extension of an idea that was proposed a long time ago. And Gordon Moe often gets credit for this, but there were others who were also involved in this idea, and that is that a planar wave degenerates into a reentry circuit of a circus movement type, and I'll define what that is in a little bit, and that reentry circuit then degenerates into multiple wavelets. And I want to review the history of that a little bit because I think it informs us in terms of what we've tried to do in the past and why it hasn't worked, and what we might do to avoid a similar failure in the future. This particular idea of planar wave to spiral wave to multiple wavelets involves a characteristic of the heart known as restitution. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that concept, maybe two of you, I wanted to review it just briefly and also to point out that the original rationale for having Jim Weiss present this talk was that he and his co-workers, Peng-Shin Chen and Alan Garfinkel and Hargur Karaguzian and an army of postdocs have been the major proponents of this idea that restitution has something to do with wave dynamics and that has something to do with ventricular fibrillation. All of that coming from Alain Karmer's papers in the 90s showing that, and also my buddy Dante Chiavo's ideas, which nobody ever heard about except me. Okay. So with that as an introduction, restitution then for action potential duration can be explained in many ways. I want to use a model that Jeff Fox has developed in our lab to study this sort of behavior. And essentially what it says is that if you take a piece of cardiac tissue and you pace it at some constant cycle length or period T, each stimulus will induce an action potential that has a given duration. And following the repolarization of that action potential, there will be an interval, a diastolic interval, that precedes the next action potential. And one can predict the duration of this action potential if the previous diastolic interval is known in the steady state. And so, in other words, this duration is a function of the preceding diastolic interval. But there's an additional complication, or probably several additional complications, but one that we've been trying to deal with, and that is this quantity of so-called memory. And here, memory is simply displayed as something that increases during the action potential and dissipates in the interval between action potentials. And so now the duration of the action potential becomes not only a function of the preceding diastolic interval, but also of this memory variable. And generally this goes that the longer this preceding rest interval, the longer will be the succeeding active interval. In addition to restitution of action potential duration, in other words, the dependence of duration on the preceding diastolic interval, there's also restitution of conduction velocity, and that goes according to the same type of behavior. The longer the rest interval, the faster the subsequent conduction. And this has implications when you're thinking about propagation through fibers. And let me just give you a cartoon explanation for that. Here we have a cardiac fiber. We're stimulating it at one end, and we're recording at this end and at this end. And if we stimulate it twice in succession, each of these action potentials, having occurred after a long diastolic interval, will conduct at maximum velocity, and they'll arrive at the distal end of the fiber with this small delta T. On the other hand, if we stimulate the fiber first with a long action potential that followed a long diastolic interval, and then follow that stimulus with a short coupled stimulus such that now we have a short diastolic interval, This action potential being preceded by the long diastolic interval will conduct rapidly, as this one did. However, this action potential following the short diastolic interval will conduct slowly and will appear at the other end of the fiber at some delta T greater than it would have if it had traveled at maximum velocity. And this consideration will become important later on when I talk about some dynamics in cables. So this isn't just an idea. In fact, the idea was derived from data. And let me just, again, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, show you some data. This is action potential duration now expressed as a function of the preceding diastolic interval. And this is from dog ventricle that was paced at different frequencies to obtain different diastolic intervals. And you can see that as the diastolic interval increases, so too does the action potential duration. And that there is a region of relatively steep slope at short diastolic intervals and shallower slope at long diastolic intervals. And this gives rise to a phenomenon known as alternans in the cardiac parlance, or two-to-two phase locking. And one can see this type of phenomenon if you pace this preparation at a long cycle length, 400 milliseconds, there is only one action potential duration. However, as you shorten the cycle length, you undergo this period doubling bifurcation when now you have long followed by short, long followed by short. And if you plot these points, all of these points, on this graph, you see that the bifurcation occurs in the region of the restitution relation where the slope is 1. Okay, so this is dynamics 101. And it applies then in the steady state to at least normal dog endocardium. So that's
some range of total T.
Yes.
That's suitably chosen. I mean, you can't extend those at will. There's some range, right?
Correct. So if you're too long, you get 1-to-1. And what I haven't shown here is if you get too short, you go to 2-to-1. So only every other stimulus creates a response. Unless this has a hook on it, then I'm going to show you there's some other nuances to this. Okay. So that's my basic primer on restitution, and you'll probably hear more about that from Alan Garfinkel later. But I wanted to now just back up for a second to talk about circus movement reentry, because this is going to lead into what I'm going to present in terms of what we're doing at the moment. And it's a pretty simple concept. You have this loop, and this would then correspond to healthy or relatively healthy tissue surrounding a scar that Bill Stevenson was just talking about. But in some region of this loop, we have tissue that is surviving, but it is, quote, sick. And sick tissue has the characteristic feature that the refractory period of this tissue is longer than the refractory period of the normal tissue. In other words, the tissue requires more time between stimuli to respond. And I've simply indicated that by this square wave, which here has a longer duration than here. So if an impulse comes into this area, it will conduct through this region, it will conduct through this region. Eventually these wave fronts will collide because they have refractory wakes. They cannot move through one another, so the collision results in annihilation. However, after one activation of the circuit, if another beat for some reason were to come down very soon thereafter, some hiccup in sinus rhythm or a PVC, and we'll ignore where that might come from for the moment, then this region, one of three things can happen. And this is sort of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, in that if the premature occurs very soon after the initial beat, as labeled here at 1, then it will block in both of these limbs of the circuit. In other words, the impulse will come down, find this tissue refractory, and find this tissue refractory. On the other hand, if the coupling interval of the stimulus is too long, it will conduct both through the damaged region and through the normal region, as shown in 3. On the other hand, if the timing is just right or just wrong, however you look at it, then, as shown here in 2, this impulse will block in this region, but it will conduct in this region. And one will then have block here, conduction around the loop, and if the time elapsed around the loop is sufficiently long, it will now find this region after it has its refractory period has expired, and that may set up this self-sustaining reentrant loop. So this is the paradigm which began really in the late 1890s when people were looking at jellyfish who come preloaded with a calcium-sensitive dye, and they glow when you stimulate them. And they made ornate patterns out of these things, circles and figure of eights and all kinds of things. And it would stimulate one end, and they'd watch this impulse revolve. And Schmidt and Erlanger generally get the credit for realizing that this might happen in the heart. And they made this triangular diagram. And what this sort of behavior led to...
So minds, the person gets credit for interpreting them. But really, historically, where's the first understanding coming from?
Yeah, so I'll include minds in that also. Well, Mines was the only one who actually tested it on himself, unfortunately. Yeah. So what this led to was the idea that reentry, which was the underlying cause for most ventricular tachycardias and therefore for sudden cardiac death eventually, was the result of an intrinsic heterogeneity. One site of this circuit had a longer action, had a longer refractory period than the other site. So if you want to stop this kind of thing, what are your options? Well, you want to convert this unidirectional block, where the impulse only blocks here and then comes around, to bidirectional block. And there are at least two ways to do that. One is that you can equalize the refractory periods on both sides of this loop. And there are two ways to do that. Either you can prolong this one until it equals this, or you can shorten this one until it equals this. From a practical standpoint, very difficult to shorten refractoriness in a damaged region. And so the other option is to prolong refractoriness in this area. And that has been done by the use of potassium channel blockers, so-called class 3 drugs. The other option is that if the impulse blocks here and comes around, maybe you can get it to block here on this side of the damaged area. And you can do that by taking the slow conduction that is already present in this damaged area and converting it to no conduction. All right, so this is the if it's sick, kill it kind of strategy, where you deliver a drug that will wipe out conduction through this damaged zone, or depress excitability. And this is what the sodium channel blockers do, or at least that's what they were designed to do. So why am I bothering to go through all of this? The reason I'm bothering with this is that, again, this was the dominant paradigm for a long period of time, and lots of people were given sodium channel blocking drugs in an effort to create bidirectional block here and interrupt this loop. And what was shown in several large clinical trials, both retrospective analysis and prospective, was that patients who got these kinds of drugs not only did not have a lower incidence of sudden death, in most cases they had a higher incidence. So that idea didn't work. And more recently, the potassium channel blockers have been evaluated in a SWORD trial, and there are a number of issues here that don't relate directly to this scheme, but nevertheless, they haven't been effective either. Okay, so it looks like the idea of targeting intrinsic heterogeneity, at least pharmacologically, is not a good idea. So what's a better idea? Maybe.
If you could speed up conduction, which is probably not possible, it could also be another solution. Because
yes.
You reach the refractory period.
Correct. Yeah, good point. So theoretically, you want the tail to catch the head. So if this blocks, and if this comes around fast enough, then it will engage this region when it's still refractory, and it'll block. But you can't accelerate conduction in the heart. It always goes as fast as it's going to go anyway. So the way to do that is to reduce the size of this loop. And in order to do that, you have to get rid of the scar. And as Bill told you, the main idea these days is not to get rid of it, but to make a bigger scar, maybe one here. And that will interrupt the loop.
Sounds like another solution would be to have, if you could have, I don't know the technology, but along that, let's go back to that circuit, a short circuit. So instead of cutting, you're trying, you put a little piece of wire to that you would identify the circuit by short circuit, that would also be a solution. That's, I guess,
Yeah, but unfortunately, what's probably happening is the opposite, that you have a short circuit, and then you have a further infarct, and it knocks that out, and then you're in trouble. Okay, so what I'd like to do is to take the flip side of this and talk not about the intrinsic heterogeneity, where one site has a longer refractive period than another in the baseline, but dynamical heterogeneity. And again, as I said, this feeds off of work from the UCLA and Cedars-Sinai group. And let me just show you an example of what I'm talking about here. This happens to be from an ionic model that we've been using, and it illustrates the principle, and then I'll use a simpler model to actually to talk about what we've done with this. But this is a one-dimensional cable. It is homogeneous, so each cell on this cable, and there are about 200 of them, are exactly alike, and they're each endowed with this ionic model that generates a cardiac action potential. So we stimulate this end of the fiber at some fixed cycle length, and I haven't shown you the train of stimuli that we use to get to some steady state. And these action potentials then propagate down the fiber. If we deliver a premature stimulus, S2, at a particular interval, you'll notice that the duration of the action potentials changes as they move down the fiber. So we start with something that's much shorter action potential duration than the basic beat, but as the action potential propagates, the duration gets longer. Well, why is that? It's primarily because this short coupling interval resulted in a short diastolic interval, which results in slow conduction. So as the action potential conducts slowly, that means now that there's a longer diastolic interval preceding these latter action potentials, which results in a longer action potential duration. If we allow some time to elapse and then deliver an S3 stimulus, now we have a fairly long diastolic interval, which means longer action potential duration, means faster conduction. So this action potential wavefront then begins to catch up, if you will, with the preceding wavefront, such that the diastolic intervals here are shorter than they started out, which means that the APD is going to be shorter than it started out. Finally, if we deliver an S4 and a closely coupled interval, you'll see again a short diastolic interval, which means slow conduction, and now we have long diastolic intervals at the distal end of the fiber, resulting in a long action potential duration. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. Here we started with something where the repolarization was synchronous across. Each action potential had more or less the same duration. But now the action potentials are changing duration as they move down the fiber. We're creating a spatial dispersion of repolarization. And if the S5 is delivered at an appropriate time, now it catches up with the previous wavefront and blocks. So we have dispersion of repolarization, dispersion of refractoriness, and we have conduction block in this 1D cable that is the result solely of dynamic heterogeneity. There's no intrinsic heterogeneity here. So we wanted to investigate a little further what the properties of this kind of system might be, and for that we went back to this memory model, but instead of pasting it at a constant cycle length, we pasted it at a constant cycle length for a while, but then introduce these premature stimuli, S2, S3, S4, S5. And some of you have already heard this story. We had some undergraduates who have now permanently been disabused in the notion of going into science because we had them manually adjusting these intervals and determining what the outcome was. And then finally, Jeff Fox wrote a program that determined all possible combinations of these intervals and obtained the following result. I'm going to skip that. And this slide requires a little bit of description because you're probably not used to looking at this kind of display. Again, just to remind you, we've been pacing in some constant cycle length, and then we deliver S2, 3, 4, 5 at various combinations. And what's plotted here is on this axis S2 minus S2 min. Well, S2 min is this dotted line. In other words, you can't go any shorter than S2 min or you hit the refractory period. So this is S2 reference to S2 min. Was it 5 milliseconds longer, 10, 15, etc.? And then plotted on this axis is the same thing for S3. So this is S3 minus S3 min. And then piled on top of the S2 and S3s are all S4s and S5s, which we don't show because we don't have enough dimensions on the graph. Yep.
Why S5? It could be S6 or S3. I think S3 would be the minimum.
Yes.
To create a block, if you were to use more of the steep part of the induction velocity restitution, so that you get bigger gradients.
Yes.
Created per beat.
Yes.
Is S5 sort of a compromise that, you know, this usually the gain in TV is small, and so
right. S3 would be sufficient. You could go to S7, S9. So as long as you set up this ping-ponging, this oscillation, then every odd one is going to have the potential for block.
But if you stop at S3, maybe the undergraduate will do that.
Yeah.
Stay inside.
So why S5? Right. Why make it 5-dimensional?
Just because it's the incidence of block is increased markedly as you go out to an S5. You have to really tune this exactly in order to get the S3 to block.
Okay.
So you can get it, but it's more difficult.
And that's what the plateau is.
Right.
You can see a little plateau that's above zero.
Yeah. So what this shows then is that the incidence of block, and there were 67,000 combinations, more or less, that produced block. But they weren't randomly distributed. They peaked at this particular site, which represents an S2 that was very closely coupled. So it was within 5 milliseconds of S2 min. But an S3 that was not closely coupled, it was out maybe 50 milliseconds from S2 min, from S3 min. And then different combinations of S4 and S5. Right? And just to remind you why that is, okay, you want the S2 to be closely coupled so that it will conduct slowly, the S3 to be coupled at some later time so that it will conduct rapidly to set up this alternans pattern. Okay, so what this simple model allows us to do then is to vary the determinants of the model and observe what happens to this incidence of conduction block. And again, in the control state we have 67,000 combinations that produce block, and that's associated with an APD restitution curve that is this black curve. So that's the control of the wild type. So what happens if you flatten the restitution? And you can flatten it a little, which is the red, or you can flatten it a little more, which is the green. And as you flatten it, the incidence of block drops to here about 40,000 and here to about 21,000. Okay, so for those of you who have been following the restitution story, there are a couple of pieces of news here. One is that the slopes of the restitution relation now are less than 1, which means we no longer have the opportunity for alternans. But yet we still have conduction block. So the alternans is not the sine qua non of the conduction block. If you have sufficiently steep restitution, you will still get block. You'll just get less of it as the restitution relation has a shallower slope. And conversely, if we steepen the restitution relation as shown in blue, then we greatly amplify the number of cases of block from 60,000 to 360,000. One can also then alter memory and determine the effect of those alterations on the incidence of block. And once again, we have the black curve, which is the restitution relation in the presence of the normal amount of memory in the model. If we increase the memory, then we reduce the action potential durations, but the slope of the restitution relation may or may not be affected, usually isn't, depending on how much we reduce.
Memory for people, I don't think they know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry?
Memory, I don't think most people know what memory.
Okay. I'm here. I'm sorry?
I don't know if people know what memory is.
Okay, so memory was that quantity. Here. All right, so memory is, and the different, memory exists in the heart on different time scales. So you can have memory that lasts for months. You can have memory that's on a minute-to-minute basis. This is beat-to-beat memory. And what this represents is the fact that is an explanation of an empirical finding that if you pace a piece of cardiac tissue at some cycle length and then deliver an extra stimulus, the duration of that of the response to that extra stimulus depends on the frequency at which you've been pacing the tissue previously. What do I mean by that? If you pace a piece of tissue rapidly so that all the durations are short, and then you wait for 1,000 milliseconds and deliver a stimulus, you'll get an action potential with a duration of 150. If you pace the preparation slowly and give it that same 1,000 millisecond rest, the duration will be 250. All right, so the heart remembers that it's being paced rapidly and had short action potential duration, or it remembers or it forgets that it was, and you have a long duration.
How do you model that? Yeah. You do it as a dependence of the action potential duration on more than the formula. You do it very clearly,
recalculate it.
So
Okay?
Calculated and can also be...
So this is, the memory then becomes, at this time, is a function of the memory that you started with, and is a function of the duration over which it increased, and the interval over which it decreased. Okay? So when we change this by changing the time constant.
But you just put that previous slide with that, that they arrive from anything.
I'm sorry, Peter.
You don't derive that from anything.
It's phenomenological.
Right.
Yeah.
It's empirical.
It's empirical, yes. And we're using the same time constant for the accumulation as we are for the dissipation. That's a guess. Maybe that's not right. This is the very poorly quantifiable...
When you say you change memory, that means you change this time constant.
Yeah,
well, yes.
Actually, there should be an alpha in front of the m,
yeah,
in the equation for d, and we change the alpha. So we didn't pull with the time constants. We just changed the amount of...
Ah, that's right. Yeah, so there is something missing here. Okay.
I was actually confused. No, if you go back to these, but I'm confused about something elementary, and that is n.
Yes. Okay.
What is n? Why is that the thing I'm supposed to focus on?
Okay.
Yes. Capital N.
N is simply the number of combinations that produce block.
Why is that a figure of merit?
Okay. It's a figure of merit because...
Other things being equal somehow...
Right. We're equating this with the probability of premature stimuli creating block. All right. So if you have several premature stimuli, if you have a short run of ventricular tachycardia, what is the probability that that will set up the conduction block that then degenerates into ventricular fibrillation?
Related to Kerr's question, I think he's asking about the normalization. It's 67,000 out of how many? How many did not produce block? Because you need to know the ratio.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's 67,000 out of 10 million, you know, that's...
Yeah, what were the totals?
And it's also assuming
it depends
all
on what
these
your...
combinations are equally likely, which is also somewhat
arbitrary. Right.
You search through this space with the resolution of 1 millisecond, and I don't remember exactly what the normalization is. I don't remember what exactly the length of the search is, but it's for some fixed amount. Each one of the S.
But I think it's absolutely crucial because you can have, you know, a sequence of 5 PVC. The question is, you know, it's a very particular sequence that you need to set these to block.
Mm-hmm.
And is it, you know, 67,000, 1 millisecond over, you know, maybe a 50 millisecond for each beat? So if it, let's say 50 times 50 times, so 50 to the fifth power.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? That's much larger than this.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so,
right.
So
no.
Basically.
Thank goodness it is.
Right.
But then I'm, you know, say, is it clinically relevant what you're telling me? Because it sounds like if it's 67,000 out of 50 to the fifth, it's going to be, you know, that's maybe why sudden cardiac is rare. It's going to be a very, very small fraction.
Right. Yeah. But that's exactly.
That absolute.
Yeah, that's what
Kerr
is asking about. The normalization is absolutely crucial.
Okay.
You know
we're
saying to change. Yeah, but I don't know what is the.
Wait, I don't know what it is. What you're seeing there is a histogram of 67,000 points.
Yes.
So you see, it's kind of self. What you see is the big areas are much bigger than the small areas. So Jeffrey sampled 67,000 points. There's the histogram.
No.
That's the point.
That's the point.
Okay, but that is the point in the sense that, yes, there are...
By N0. All of these are divided by N0.
Okay.
Right.
You change the area of the ground.
Right. You vary the proportion of the height.
In that area, which is...
Okay. You vary by how much? How many milliseconds?
Roughly
50. So it's 50 to the fifth power.
Mm-hmm.
What is that number? Let's take 10.
100 to the fifth divided by 2 to the fifth.
So it's 100,000.
Right.
It's a million. Okay, so that's significant. So 67,000 out of a million. That's,
okay. Right. But whatever the number is, the conclusion is that there are very, 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 very many more combinations that don't produce block than produce block. All right. So you have to be, to some extent, unlucky in order to get this particular sequence of events. All right. But still, you, there are 67,000 chances that might happen.
There's a finite probability that all the molecules in this room will go in one corner here.
Right.
But it's 10 to the minus 26, and so nobody talks about
okay.
it.
All right,
so that's what we're talking about. You know?
All right, but
how likely is it?
All right, but let me let that ride because that's a point I want to make actually later on. Okay.
I argue that it doesn't matter what the denominator is because what he's looking at is three different pictures, and what he cares about is the ratio of the answers for one picture.
If the denominator is the same.
Right.
I'm assuming he does.
No, because, okay, you're saying, okay, so yes. 10 to minus 26 for all the molecules over here, and then to go in my cup is 10 to minus 25, let's say. And you're saying, well, all that I care is 10 to minus 26 or 10 to minus 25. Okay, it's how much more probable is it that they all go to the cup for the rest of the corner? But if they're both very improbable, I don't care. Okay, so it's not just the ratio of how more probable is to go there, it's whether those things are relevant. So you care about the output.
Yes, but in the final analysis, would you rather have this number be 67,000 or zero?
No, I'm just saying it's very interesting that you see the restitution from 67,000 to 300,000,
right.
Which is all very relevant. Right. But I want to know what is still, you know, what's okay. the number that did not produce blood, so I know what fraction are we talking about
okay.
to know what is clinically relevant. That's just it's a very, very simple question.
Right. No, that is. And it... Okay. It depends on the resolution with which we do this.
Yeah, but I estimated if you say 50, then right. you change it by 50 milliseconds at a 90 second interval.
Right.
So it's roughly 50 to the fifth, which is
right.
about 1 million.
Right.
So I think it is relevant.
Okay, good.
You look at those conditions in 1 millisecond, and something happens, you get 1 pound when it comes, but it's 29 milliseconds, something like that. If it never happens later, then, you know, who cares?
Exactly.
Right. So the point is really, if this 67,000 doesn't mean probably anything, and
yeah.
so what do you believe? What is it?
The point is we
may yeah.
move on.
Exactly, and I'm going to come to that, okay? All right, so let me come to that. All right. So what we have is a very simple system. All right. So it's a homogeneous one-dimensional cable. If you pace it at certain intervals, then you can induce conduction block that is solely the result of dynamic heterogeneity. It doesn't have anything to do with intrinsic heterogeneity. So what does that have to do with real arrhythmias in the real heart? Because we know that the heart is heterogeneous. So we had an opportunity to test out this idea in the context of another experiment that I'm not going to go into. And what we did was to see whether, in fact, these kinds of intervals would produce ventricular fibrillation in a real heart and a real animal. And the real animal in this case is a normal beagle dog that's been anesthetized. And it's in a closed test, so we haven't exposed the heart. We're measuring the usual things, one of them being an MAP recording. So this is a monophasic action potential. We can't record action potentials from the myocardium because that requires use of an electrode that won't stay in the myocardium. So instead we use this MAP catheter. And we determine MAP duration restitution, which is analogous to APD restitution, using a standard protocol for S1 to S4. And I'll explain what that is in a minute, and a so-called dynamic protocol. And then we took the results of these and put them into the algorithm to make predictions about what intervals should produce VF in these dogs and what intervals should not, most of them being in the to not category. So we then attempted to induce ventricular fibrillation using what I'll call a standard premature protocol. And this relates to what clinical cardiologists used to do in people back when they thought that this was a useful technique. And what they would do is assume that they had this reentry loop of circus movement reentry that I described for you earlier. They would send in several premature stimuli to induce an arrhythmia. If they could induce the arrhythmia, they then gave the patient a drug, usually a class 1 drug or a class 3 drug. They repeated the procedure. If they could no longer induce the arrhythmia, they sent the patient home, and the patient went home and died suddenly because those drugs didn't prevent their VF. All right? So we did that protocol on these dogs, not expecting to induce ventricular fibrillation in these normal beagles, and we never did. And we did this so-called ICB protocol. This is the protocol based then on the predictions from the one-dimensional model. And this is an example of some recordings from one of those experiments. This is the MAP from the left ventricle. This is the MAP from the right ventricle. We're driving the right ventricle at the site of this MAP. And here is the last stimulus of a train of stimuli at a constant cycle length, S1. Now we deliver a closely coupled S2. You notice that the duration here is shorter than for the previous stimulus, because it's a shorter interval. But as the impulse propagates away from this site of stimulation in the right ventricle to the left ventricle, you notice that the short action potential gets long. We then deliver an S3 at a slightly longer interval. This longer action potential, as it propagates, gets short. We then deliver the S4 to get another short action potential, so that we have long, short, long, short. This short action potential gets a little longer, and then things get a little fuzzy as we go into ventricular fibrillation.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Did you first model these functions that you talked about for this particular organism, or?
Yes. So, yes and no. The model that I showed you, the one-dimensional cable model,
that depended on this other dynamical model.
Yes. Right? Yes.
That
correct.
Recursion,
yes.
Recursion relations that were.
Yes. So the.
How did you get that?
The data for that model were obtained experimentally. We used experiments from dogs, isolated dog myocardium, to generate that model.
Those are the restitution curves and all that stuff.
Right. So the CV restitution.
Generated.
Yes. So the APD restitution, the CV restitution, and to a certain extent how we modeled the memory was based on experimental measurements from isolated dog myocardia. So now we're going back to the intact dog, the intact heart, and using that as a predictor for what kind of intervals should we give in order to produce ventricular fibrillation. And as I, okay, so we have two sites, one on the right ventricle, one on the left ventricle. This is not high density mapping. You know, Bill was talking about he's only got 120 points. We only have 2 points. So this needs to be done in the presence of a higher density mapping at least. But the initial results, and these are unpublished and preliminary, indicate that maybe this idea isn't so crazy after all. And if you go back then to this diagram, remember that these were the intervals that were predicted from the model to be those most likely to produce conduction block in the model. And these were the intervals then that we delivered to the dogs. And the filled symbols indicate 6 dogs, 2 trials and 1 dog. And in every case, we produced ventricular fibrillation. Now, we don't have the ability or the patients to do all 67,000 combinations, so we did the ones that we thought were the most likely, and then we tried some combinations that were outside of this region, and the unfilled symbols indicate that when we did that, we did not get ventricular fibrillation. Okay, so that's a normal Beagle. What we then went on to look at was a group of dogs that are not normal, and these are a group of German Shepherd dogs, originally discovered by Sidney Moise at Cornell. And these dogs have an inherited predisposition to sudden death. So they have, as you can see from this ECG recording, this is a Holter recording, they have multiple episodes of reasonably nasty looking, non-sustained ventricular tachycardia. And when you look at a lot of these dogs, I'm sorry?
What's the mechanism of the arrhythmia in those dogs?
Is that a genetic, catecholaminergic, polymorphic VP?
No. And what you'll notice is that almost all of these runs occur after a long pause. So if these dogs have a peculiarity in their sympathetic innervation, their right ventricles are normally innervated sympathetically, their left ventricles are not. If you take the left ventricular Purkinje fibers out and put them in a tissue bath, they generate early after depolarization induced triggered activity. And I don't have time to explain what that is for those of you who don't already know. We can talk about it later. So this is a particular kind of initiating mechanism for tachycardias. If you take the right Purkinje out from the normally innervated right ventricle, it's very well behaved. It doesn't do anything. All right, so the only point I want to make here is that if you look at ventricular arrhythmias on a 24-hour Holter and we stop counting at about 6,000, and you look at that for 72 dogs that have been studied, There's a continuum of affectedness, but there are a great many dogs that are very severely affected. So these dogs have a lot of VT, and they die suddenly. So that's not a surprise. The surprise is that they don't die suddenly sooner. If a dog is having lots and lots of ectopy day after day, why doesn't that dog die? Well, that dog, we think, doesn't die because the intervals of the ventricular tachycardia are not the intervals that are needed in order to produce ventricular fibrillation. So in this normalization, this dog's having lots and lots of PVCs, but they're not at the right interval in order to create VF. And so in an effort to get at whether that in fact is the case, we then took these German Shepherds and anesthetized them and measured the same sorts of things that we had been measuring previously. In addition, what we did was to take their Holters and record and measure the intervals that they were generating spontaneously. So this is ventricular tachycardia from one of the records that I just showed you. So we go in and we measure these intervals, and then we make a library of those intervals so that we can deliver them back to the dog at a time when it's not developing these intervals, and compare what happens when you do that with what happens when we deliver the intervals that we predicted should cause ventricular fibrillation. And let me concentrate on the negative results first. So these are the intervals that the dog has been spontaneously developing and that we then delivered back into the dog just to make sure that there wasn't something going on with our stimulation protocol. And you notice that these intervals are not within this mountain of intervals that would be predicted to cause ventricular fibrillation. On the other hand, when we deliver these intervals artificially in three of the four dogs, we did get ventricular fibrillation.
Memory, in principle, you know, you argue that memory is important.
Yes.
How do you know that for this?
Because we measure that. We measure the restitution relations at the beginning of the experiment.
And the memory?
Well, you can't measure the memory.
Okay, so you're just going on to the S1, S2.
Right. Yeah, we can estimate the memory if we back calculate, but we don't do that in the lab. We don't have time
S1,
to do that.
S2 was enough to be a good predictor.
Right. Okay.
Well, how do you know
the Holter
recording?
I'm sorry, Walter?
With the Holter recording.
What about it?
How do you know it's coming from a single side?
Ah, yeah, we don't. But we have a pretty good idea that it is because of the in vitro studies with the Purkinje fibers. But we don't know that for sure. So it could be that, yes, these intervals are coming from various sites. I'd be real surprised if that happened in these dogs, but it's possible. Well, it's polymorphic, but I think it's polymorphic because of conduction block coming out of the Purkinje fibers, not because it's coming from different sites. Yes, right. So we go through the same protocol that we did to generate the original data. And then, frankly, I sit there and I look at the data and I calculate what these ought to be. So we don't actually put it in and generate all 67,000 again. Okay, so this is, you know, very preliminary data. It suffers from the same sort of problem that I just talked about with respect to if you focus solely on intrinsic heterogeneity, you're likely to miss the boat in terms of what's causing these arrhythmias, and it's likely that we're doing the same thing here. We're focusing solely on solely on dynamic heterogeneity, and I'd be very surprised if there wasn't some overlap between the two. But given that, let's assume then that this dynamic heterogeneity does play some role in the development of conduction block, which leads to tachycardia and fibrillation. So what are our options then about intervening to prevent this kind of behavior? And essentially they fall into three groups: drugs, gene therapy, and devices. And I'm going to just briefly talk about the calcium channel antagonists. That's an old story that I'm sure most of you have heard. This is a figure from Jeff Fox's AJP paper indicating that in a computer model, when you have alternans of action potential duration, long, short, that's associated with an alternans of calcium current, large, small, and that also happens in real tissue. Here, this is an isolated dog, ventricular myocyte, that we're delivering. This is action potential clamp, and you can see that we have long, short here, accompanied by large, small, large, small. Now, I should point out that you can decouple these two, and maybe Alan will have something to say about that. But at least in the normal myocyte, that relationship pertains. And so if you block calcium current with verapamil, you reduce the slope of the restitution relation and thereby reduce the amount of alternans. So this is alternans magnitude as a function of pacing cycle length. The shorter the cycle length, the greater the alternans during control. Once you flatten the restitution relation, you virtually eliminate the alternans. So that would then suggest that you should get rid of ventricular fibrillation. And at least in arterially perfused isolated dog myocardium, you do. This is a space-time plot from an array of electrodes during control ventricular fibrillation, and you can see that the activation is very aperiodic. And at T equals 1, we started verapamil exposure, and over time, the recordings become more organized until we've converted what is presumably multiple spiral wave reentry into a single spiral wave. And again, that's old news. Why does that work? Well, in the simplest way, it works for this reason. If we have, under normal circumstances, a long diastolic interval, then calcium current, as indicated by this red line, has time to recover fully from the previous excitation, such that it contributes fully to this action potential, making the duration long because we're now increasing this inward depolarizing current. However, if we follow this action potential with a short diastolic interval, now the current doesn't have time to recover fully. We have less inward current during the subsequent action potential, which contributes to its shorter duration. And of course, it isn't, the durations are not determined solely by calcium current, so it's only a contributory role. If we knock down available calcium current so that the maximum now, instead of being here, is here, now when there is time for full recovery, there still will be less current, which will result in a short duration, which will result in a long interval following this short duration, which will result in full recovery again. So even though we have less current, because it's fully recovered each time, its contribution is constant, action potential to action potential. So if this is true, and it isn't the simplest case, then if we could shorten action potential duration by some other means, other than reducing calcium current, we should obtain the same effect. And that has been tested. And we've looked at every current that we have in the ionic model. And I'm going to focus today on a particular potassium current. This is the rapid component of the delayed rectifier. So again, for those of you who aren't used to thinking about cardiac cells, the duration of the action potential is determined by a balance of inward current, primarily calcium current, and outward current, primarily potassium current. So if you want to shorten the duration of the action potential, you need to increase the amount of outward current. You need to increase IKR. And if you look at the amplitude of the alternans in the ionic model, as you increase the amount of IKR, you do decrease the amplitude of the alternans. This is the wild-type value, so if we increase IKR, we get less alternans, and conversely, if we decrease IKR, we get more alternans. And there are various ways that you can change IKR, and I'm not going to spend much time on this except to say that you can do it by changing the kinetics of the gating variables for the current, or you can simply just make more channels. You can increase the maximum conductance for the current. And this is of some interest to us as modelers, but it's really of academic interest to a physiologist, in the sense that we can't do any of these things with drugs. There are no drugs, other than one drug that Pfizer might have that they won't give me, that increases IKR. Oh, and this is just to make the point that this is the wild type model where we have alternans at certain pacing cycle lengths. If we change IKR, in other words, if we increase it by changing the conductance or the gating variables, we get approximately the same, or we can get the same effect, which is to eliminate the alternans without really changing the restitution relation all that much. So we don't need to drastically shorten action potential duration in order to get rid of the alternans. So as I said, though, that's not something that we can do experimentally with drugs. So we've had to resort to molecular biology and take advantage of the fact that the gene for the pore-forming domain for the channel that carries IKR, which is a human etheroGoGo-related gene, or now KCNH2, has been identified and cloned. And so we can introduce this gene into myocytes, and if we can't increase the conductance of the channels that are already there, we can make the myocyte make more channels. And we do that by coupling this gene to an adenovirus and infecting the cells. And if you look at the current on day zero of isolating the cells, these experiments are done in isolated myocytes. This is the current, and you don't need to be an electrophysiologist to appreciate the fact that after 3 days of exposure to the adenovirus of HERG, we have a massive increase in current. So the myocytes are taking up the adenovirus. They are now expressing this channel. We have more channels, therefore we have more current. If we have more current, do we have less alternans? And the answer to that is yes. This is pacing a myocyte at 0 days before the current is being overexpressed. You can see we have alternans, long, short, long, short. And this is after 3 days. Now we have all short action potentials. And regardless of what cycle length you pace these cells at, they don't develop alternans. So that's the good news in the sense that if we infect the cells, we increase IKR, we get rid of alternans. So now we'd like to do that in a whole heart and see whether we can get rid of ventricular fibrillation. But adult hearts don't like to take up virus, which is good for us but bad for the experiments. So we need another way to get to overexpress this current in cardiac myocytes, and we've been looking at several different ways, and I just want to briefly talk about one, which involves the use of what are called nanobiohybrids. And this is something that was developed by Emmanuel Gianellis in material science at Cornell, and he and his graduate student Skippy Kiner are using these. And essentially you create this clay gallery, this sandwich, and then you replace what came with the sandwich with what you want to introduce into the cell. This is biocompatible material. Most cells recognize this, engulf it. In the relatively acidic environment of the intracellular space, the bread is hydrolyzed off, leaving your molecule of interest, which you then hope migrates to the appropriate place and does the appropriate thing. And we're in the early stages of these kinds of experiments, but what we have done so far is to pack these nanohybrids with GFP, constitutively active GFP, such that when the nanobiohybrid is taken up by the cells, they then express GFP and they glow green. And so the next step then is to see if we can get ERG into these cells and get it expressed. Okay, so that's the gene therapy, long way off. And I'm going to truncate this part of it. This is the, there's a third way to do this, which is devices. And this relates to the subject of so-called alternans control or even chaos control. And what I was going to show you were some data that we had in 1996 to indicate that we could do this very nicely in a single cell and convert a period doubling bifurcation into chaos into something that was very periodic. And so that gave us some hope that we could, through electrical means, control alternans. And then Alain and his co-worker came along and spoiled the party by showing the following. This is a control scheme, which is very simple, where you pace a piece of tissue at a given interval, and you monitor action potential duration in consecutive beats. And if there's a difference between the two, then you change the period by some small amount, depending upon what your gain variable is. That's the gamma. And that allows you then to control the alternans. And Dan Gaudier and others have used this technique, Dave Christini, and it works quite well in an isolated myocyte. However, once you have a cable, and this represents a cable in this case of about 3 centimeters long, and this is the APD profile for consecutive beats, so this is the nth, n plus one, during pacing at a constant cycle length, you can see here that we have an alternans behavior. So every other action potential is long, short, long, short. And the control algorithm here is not turned on. If you turn it on, you do a nice job of controlling alternans at the site of stimulation. So the control algorithm converts this large alternans to essentially no alternans, but only at the site of stimulation. You notice that as you move down the fiber, the alternans persist. And I think Alana is going to talk a little bit about this tonight. So I'm not going to go into the math behind this, other than to say that one has then this spatial distribution of alternans that is not controlled by point stimuli at the origin. And if you have another phenomenon called discordant alternans, which is the long action potential getting short as it goes down the fiber, and the short action potential getting long. And you turn on the control, all you do is convert this discordant alternans into concordant alternans. So we were interested in this phenomenon and hoping that it was wrong. And so we did some experiments to find out whether that was the case. And the experiments, the setup is very simple. We have a dog Purkinje fiber, which is about the closest approximation we can make to a linear, homogeneous one-dimensional cable. It's not one-dimensional, of course, but functionally it's quasi-one-dimensional. And we record action potentials from along the fiber during pacing at a fixed cycle length. And if the cycle length is sufficiently short, we have alternans at each site. So blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red. In other words, the alternans is concordant. The fiber during one beat, everybody has a long action potential duration. During the next beat, everybody has a short action potential duration. At this point, we turn on the alternans control. And you can see that as long as it's on, there's pretty good control near the site of stimulation and at some distal sites. But as you go further down the cable, two things happen. First of all, you don't control the alternans anymore. And the alternans has flipped phase. So now instead of having long-short, you have short-long. So you've converted concordant alternans into either no alternans or discordant alternans. And we've done a number of experiments of this kind. And I won't go through the action potentials on the left. I just want to show you that the, at least qualitatively and to a surprising extent quantitatively, the results that we get in the experiments agree with what was predicted, in that if we start with alternans down the fiber and we initiate control, we don't control the other end of the fiber, just as predicted by the model. And if we start with discordant alternans and we stimulate with the control, we convert the discordant alternans to concordant alternans, again, very similar to what was predicted from the model. Okay, so let me just end then by reinforcing the idea that in the old days, the idea that heterogeneity that was intrinsically part of the tissue was responsible for the development of block that led to ventricular fibrillation probably was not correct. And the best evidence for that is that the use of drugs that ameliorated that heterogeneity did not prevent sudden death. And in fact, they had a pro-rhythmic effect in most cases. So now we're on the flip side, where we're looking at dynamical heterogeneity, and that seems to at least have the potential to contribute importantly to the development of conduction block. And if that's the case, then we have some emerging, but certainly not ready for prime time, techniques that might be tried, at least in experimental models, to see whether if we alter intrinsic dynamical heterogeneity, we can prevent ventricular fibrillation. And again, my suspicion is that it's going to lie somewhere in between by the time all is said and done. So let me just finish with some people that did the work. This is Sidney Moise and Anna Geltzer, and they are responsible in large part for the intact dog studies. Mark Riccio is an engineer that helps with the experiments and the modeling. Jeff Fox, in consultation with Eberhard, does virtually all the modeling. Marcus Kohler is a clinical cardiologist from Germany who also helped with the whole dog studies. Neil Zatani with some of the modeling. Dave Christini wrote all the software for the chaos control. And Dante Chiavo comes in and out whenever he feels like it. Okay, and that's it.